The governor's right to pick Supreme Court justices, a look back on the hurricane season, and the music of Art Week. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There is a potential constitutional crisis brewing in Tallahassee. Governor Rick Scott may have the opportunity to pick three justices for the Florida Supreme Court just as he's leaving office. A couple of groups are trying to stop him because he could make those choices in the final hours of his term. Well, this past hurricane season has been called the most expensive in recorded history. What are the lessons learned, and what might we expect for coming hurricane seasons? And it's Art Week this week in Miami, but besides good art, there's music. Lola Reskin of Sweat Records joins us to discuss what you can find to stimulate your ears during the festivities. That's all next on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, there's a case going on before the Florida Supreme Court about the Florida Supreme Court, and it has to do with who can pick the justices for the three seats that will be left open come 2019. That's also when Governor Rick Scott leaves office. There's even the possibility that Governor Scott could technically pick those three appointees in the final hour of his term. There are groups trying to stop this from happening. Earlier today, we spoke with Mary Ellen Kloss, Miami Herald Tallahassee Bureau Chief, about the peculiarities of this situation and what it could mean for the state's highest court. So we're taking a look ahead to when Governor Scott leaves office. In fact, literally his last day in office, January 8th, 2019, which is also the day that a new governor is going to be sworn in. Tell us what this has to do with the state Supreme Court.
Well, the three justices are scheduled to retire on the very same day that Governor Scott leaves office. They are Justices Barbara Pariente, Fred Lewis, and Peggy Quince. And they're retiring because they are, because of the state's mandatory retirement laws, they are required to leave the bench, and their final day is the same day the governor leaves office and his successor takes office.
So the question is, who gets to appoint those three new justices?
That's right. This is one of the things that has been around for a long time. The Florida Constitution is a little bit murky about the timing of the replacement. And for most of the Florida's history, we have not had to worry about justices retiring on the same day that a new governor takes office. And there have been a couple occasions, and in that instance, there was just one. This time around, we have three justices, and they happen to make up the liberal voting bloc of the court. So you can imagine that conservative Rick Scott wants to be able to influence, as part of his legacy, who those people are. And so that's the question we've got before us.
And how does the governor justify his argument that it should be him?
Well, he argues that he has the appointment authority to put somebody to replace them, and he is, you know, technically not allowed to appoint anyone until there's a vacancy. The conflict here is that there are many people who say that there is no vacancy until midnight on January 8th, 2019. Now, if you wait until midnight, January 8th, 2019, the new governor will have been appointed by that point. But Rick Scott's argument is that they can agree that the new governor's term may have begun, but that doesn't give the old governor the authority, that doesn't diminish the authority of the previous governor to make the appointments.
So there are lawsuits to try to keep this from happening, trying to keep Governor Scott from making this move. Who's suing to keep that from happening, and what's their argument?
Well, a lawsuit filed in June by the Florida League of Women Voters and Common Cause argues that the governor can't appoint these successors, and basically is making the point that if Governor Scott is allowed to do this, when they think it's clear he doesn't have the authority, that could set into motion a whole series of lawsuits. And then you have lawsuits against who, and who's going to decide those lawsuits. You could have three vacant spots because the three justices will have left. You could have three people chosen to replace them, but they have questionable authority because it's not clear as to whether Governor Scott had the right to do this. And so then you'd end up with four members of the court, and the opponents are saying this uncertainty really could leave us with a constitutional crisis. In many cases also, the justices that might be chosen to, or the judges that might, the people that might be chosen to be the replacements for the three leaving justices might have come from a lower court. And if those vacancies are open, there's the potential that we've got sort of all this movement and uncertainty all the way into the court system. And because that's unresolved and could be unresolved on January 8th, they claim it's a constitutional crisis.
And isn't there anything in the Florida Constitution that covers this situation?
Well, there is something, but it doesn't give us a window into the exact time. So we know that the justices must retire on the second Tuesday in January. Now, there is case law that looks at when, that's also the time the new governor must be appointed. We have precedent that the governor has been actually often is sworn, the new governor is sworn in before that day, just because we don't want to have a situation where there's somebody who's not technically in office on the day of the inauguration. So the argument is that in the past we've had governors who actually take office before their official inauguration day, but we don't have a precedent of justices taking office before that day.
So this has never happened before.
Well, what has happened before is that there was, because of this murkiness and uncertainty, when Jeb Bush took over after Lawton Chiles, they anticipated that there was an opening on the court, and at that time, they agreed. They had previously agreed, and this actually happened before Lawton Chiles even died, because he died before Jeb was inaugurated. But they agreed that they would together jointly interview the successors, potential successors for the job, and they jointly agreed to name Peggy Quince. Ironically, Justice Quince is now one of those who is retiring. But because there was this murkiness, we do have a history of having to try and navigate this uncertainty.
We're talking with Mary Ellen Kloss, Miami Herald Tallahassee Bureau Chief, and we're talking about a potential constitutional crisis dealing with the governor and whether or not he has the ability to replace three justices on the Florida Supreme Court. If Governor Scott gets his way, presumably the three new justices will all be conservative. So how does that change the balance of the court?
Well, I think it's a very good question, because what this is showing is that this is far more than just a constitutional question. This is a very big political question. And there is no doubt that the court, which now has three conservative justices, would soon go from 4-3 to 6-1. And that could have a tremendous impact on decisions that come forward. Now, in many cases, you hope that the political ideology of justices doesn't matter. But we know that there are many questions where the different ideological approaches do have an important impact on the decisions. And those are often questions of political importance as well. When it came to death penalty questions, when it comes to whether a constitutional amendment approved by the legislature is acceptable or not, all those issues have emerged in the past. And this court has, in the past, also thrown out a lot of Rick Scott's, you know, political and policy decisions. He's rejected efforts to test welfare recipients for drug testing. There's just been a whole line of efforts by this governor that have been rejected by this court.
Yeah. Has Governor Scott been pretty happy or not with the current court's decisions?
Absolutely. I would suggest that I think this court has probably been the bane of his existence in many ways as governor. They have been the one that has forced him to spend so much money, taxpayer money. Well, they haven't forced him. He has chosen to bring things forward that on their surface often people would have said would should be unconstitutional. And so they have turned down many of his initiatives because they are deemed unconstitutional.
Now, the court has heard arguments in this case last month.
Right.
Was there any indication about which way they might vote?
No. There really isn't a clear sense here as to what they're going to do. I think that this is one of those things that is an unfortunate question for the court because it's the failure of the legislature and other leaders to suggest to clarify this in a way that appeases everybody. So the court now has to kind of walk this fine line. There was an effort to amend the Constitution back in 2014, and that was a proposal by a state senator, Tom Lee, and he basically put onto the 2014 Constitution or 2014 ballot something that would have given the outgoing governor the authority to appoint just any open vacancies. And at that time, he also argued that there would be a constitutional crisis. So this is not new, but the idea of a outgoing governor being able to leave a legacy that could influence or impact the fate of the incoming governor was not something that voters supported. They rejected that by it only garnered 48% of the vote,
and it needed 60.
And it needed 60.
And it was just last week that this court made a preliminary ruling related to this case. What was that about?
So what happened is after the oral arguments that took place in early November, there was something caught on a hot mic, and it was picked up by the Florida Channel. And so the Governor Scott petitioned the court, and Justice Perianti making comments to Chief Justice LaBarga. And the exchange was, you could hardly distinguish what exactly was being said, but you could hear Perianti saying the word crazy and referring to a sheet of paper. So Governor Scott's lawyers petitioned the court and did a public records request, and they found out that the paper that she was referring to was a list of the governor's appointees to the Florida Supreme Court Judicial Nominating Commission. And this is the panel that will give the governor a list of candidates to choose from. And so Scott's lawyers basically said that this shows that Perianti cannot be unbiased, that she must have a point of view, that who's she calling crazy? And so they asked that she be recused from the case. So that would have left the court with six justices to resolve. Well, the League of Women Voters and Common Cause lawyers made the case that this there's no way you could know what she's referring to, that she should not be recused. And so the court last week in a one-sentence ruling basically said that Justice Perianti will not need to be recused from this.
And they gave no explanation on that. So
zero explanation there.
And again, that was Mary Ellen Kloss, Miami Herald Tallahassee Bureau Chief. We spoke to her earlier. Again, about the situation going on in Tallahassee, where Governor Rick Scott may have the opportunity to fill three Florida Supreme Court justice seats, or maybe not. We're going to follow up on this story, of course, as we get more information. All right, coming up next, we're going to be looking back on the 2017 hurricane season, as painful as it was. That's all next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, thank God it's over. And of course, I'm talking about the 2017 hurricane season, ended last week. Record storm after storm after storm crashed through Texas, Florida, Puerto Rico, and many of the Caribbean islands over just a couple of months. It's being called the most expensive hurricane season so far. Is this a freak year, or is it the start of more difficult storm seasons to come? My next guest, Dennis Felchin, is a meteorologist and the spokesperson for the National Hurricane Center, which, of course, is right here in Miami. Dennis, always a pleasure. How are you doing?
Good afternoon, Lewis. How are you?
Well, I'm doing good because there's hurricane season's over. I shouldn't have to worry.
Not a moment too soon, let me tell you.
All right, so you look back on the season. Harvey, Irma, Maria, which was the worst in terms of the intensity of the storm?
Well, in terms of intensity, just the sheer number, you'd have to rank probably Irma up there. 185 mile per hour winds, that ties with the Florida Keys in 35, Gilbert in 88, and Wilma in 05 for the second strongest maximum winds in the Atlantic Basin. Only Hurricane Allen in 1980 had stronger winds, and that was 190. So in terms of intensity, you have to go with Irma.
And then when we talk about casualties and damage of those three storms.
Oh, then you got to go with Maria. That's no contest.
Did we just have a bad luck year? I mean, you know, more hurricanes happened to hit the U.S. or, you know, I mean, were there actually stronger storms? I mean, what can you look back and say about 2017?
Well, let's go back a little farther than that. Let's go back to 2010. When we were going into this hurricane season, it was forecast to be the most active season since 2010. Now, in 2010, we had a dozen hurricanes out there, and a dozen hurricanes. Not a single one of those hurricanes, Lewis, struck the United States. Now, flash forward to 2017, and now we end up with 10 hurricanes, and three of those hit the United States. Actually, well, four of them, including Puerto Rico. So, yeah, so you get four of them. Hurricanes like do not move by themselves. They're steered around by the weather pattern that surrounds them at the time. And we had a pretty strong area of high pressure over the Atlantic wedged in across the southeastern United States. So rather than these storms that develop as they come off the coast of Africa and end up curving to the north, and they're more or what we would call a fish storm, they just bother the fish and nobody else, these storms have the ability to track farther west. So, and we also had them go deep into the Caribbean. So storms such as Irma and Maria and Harvey, they all had the chance to impact the United States.
Wasn't 2017 supposed to be El Nino summer?
No. There was a possibility that an El Nino might develop later on in the season, but that did not materialize. So we were essentially in a neutral year.
All right, so scientists at Colorado State University said the Atlantic was unusually warm this year. Do we know why?
I personally don't know why. It was forecast to be unusually warm, and that's exactly what happened. There was also expected to be very little wind shear out there, and that's a byproduct of an El Nino year where there's an increase in the wind shear, strong upper-level winds blowing in from the west that would disrupt systems even before they had a chance to develop. That didn't exist this year, so we had low wind shear. So warm, very unusually warm waters, which fuels the storms, low wind shear, so the storms are able to develop stronger and stronger, and a pattern which sent them down deep into the tropics and toward the U.S.
All right,
that's
so
what did it.
Sometimes you hear it. People will ask, is it global warming? And the answer usually that you get is, well, you can't tell from just one season. But aren't there scientists who say that one effect of global warming might be stronger hurricanes?
Right. That is the premise. Whether it be like 5%, it's largely in the noise of what we would have for forecasting anyway. And that the same theory is we might have fewer hurricanes in the future because global warming does increase the wind shear. So, you know, that there's a lot of uncertainty about that. But what we can tell you is that there's going to continue to be hurricanes. We're going to continue to be impacted. And it only takes one storm hitting you to make it a really bad year, and don't we know it.
Can you make any predictions about El Nino or La Nina for next year?
Little too early to tell. The signature for that just isn't present yet. You really can't predict those things out 6 months in advance.
All right, again, I'm talking with Dennis Felchin. He's a meteorologist and spokesperson for the National Hurricane Center. We're just taking a look back on this 2017 hurricane season, and really, what does it mean for the intensity of storms, the number of storms that hit us, but also in the way that we track storms? What have we learned from this past year? So, Dennis, you know what? Thinking about that, how good were the forecasts this year? When we talk about tracking the intensity, the storm surge, technology's got to be getting better, right?
Oh, certainly the technology is getting better. This year, everything is preliminary right here, Lewis, but the way it stands right now is that the National Hurricane Center's track forecast exceeded the five-year track forecast error at all time periods. So that's 12 hours through 5 days. And for the storms of Harvey, Irma, and Maria, that track forecast was 25% better than the five-year mean. So that was a real success story. But I want to tell you an even bigger success story. You heard us this year on several occasions, Harvey and Irma, and for Nate, a new watch and warning called a storm surge watch and warning. That was new this year. We had experimented with it in 2015 and 2016 when operational this year. And the first time we used it for real was with Harvey. Now, remember, hurricane watches and warnings are only for wind. They don't have anything to do with the water. And yet, nearly 90% of the fatalities that occur in hurricanes come from the water, and half of those are directly due to storm surge. And yet, we didn't have a warning for it. Well, that changed this year. So we had storm surge watches and warnings that went out for the Texas and Louisiana coastline, much of the Florida Peninsula for Irma, including the Florida Keys, and for Nate in the upper Texas coast. So this is for mainland U.S., the mainland USA. And right now, with those hurricanes, we have no known deaths directly related to storm surge this year. That's remarkable.
Let's come back to this idea of, you know, in how the technology changes. And obviously, one of the things about hurricanes is you're watching those things move across the Atlantic Ocean. It's that question of where's this going to go? And then you start getting those spider webs of possible, you know, tracks for
now
the storm.
Yeah, the spaghetti models.
The spaghetti models. Okay, we can call it that too. And so I'm wondering, you know, what's changed in that, and could it ever get better?
I think it can get better, but they'll probably reach a point where, you know, this is as good as it's going to get. Because unless you know every little nuance that's going on in the atmosphere, you'll never have it exactly right down to the point for every step along the hurricane's path. I've been doing this for more than 40 years, and I still see that as a physical impossibility because there's still more we don't know in nature than we do know. But the track forecast is much better than it was even 5 years ago, let alone 10 or 20. Where we really need to be looking at, and we're trying to build on it, is the intensity forecasting. That's still our Achilles heel. It was a little better this year, but it still needs a lot of work. And that's especially with what we call rapid intensification, where you have a hurricane gaining rapidly strengthening, like 25, 30, 40 miles per hour within a 24-hour period. And, of course, a nightmare scenario is that happening right off our doorstep. We just don't know all of the physics that go on inside that hurricane eye wall and the structure around it, which contributes to the rapid intensification. That is where we really need to place a lot of our emphasis on.
And of course, you know, we think back to Irma, and Irma was this Category 5 storm we thought was going to hit directly here in South Florida and Miami, and then it turned a little bit and weakened.
Right, and that's what we've been saying for years. If you pay attention to that skinny black line, just focusing on that, you're going to have trouble with it. Central and South Florida was in that cone, the track forecast error cone, for a number of days. And up until that Friday morning, Friday afternoon, it looked like this thing might go up the East Coast. But by Friday evening, it was obvious it was going to go into the West Coast, at least the core of it. And that's exactly what happened 36 hours later when the eye went over Cudjoe Key and then, of course, over Marco Island for its final landfall in Florida. But hurricane warnings had to be put up on both coasts. Why? Hurricanes are not a dot on a map. There are large storms with impacts over a large area. So just because you're looking to go, oh, it's going to go up the West Coast, I don't have any problem. Just look around what happened on the Southeast Coast. It's a large storm.
Yeah, at one point it seemed as though the entire state of Florida, which is a very big state, was almost completely covered by Irma.
Right, yeah. When you have a hurricane going up the spine of Florida, everybody feels the impacts of that.
Again, talking with Dennis Felchin, meteorologist and spokesperson for the National Hurricane Center, just taking a look back on this 2017 hurricane season. Dennis, you know, we heard so much about Irma being this windstorm, and Harvey was a rainstorm, right? What's the difference in storm types then?
Well, they were both major hurricanes, Category 4 hurricanes at landfall. Irma continued moving on up at a steady pace up the west coast of Florida and eventually dissipated as it got up over to Georgia. Harvey didn't do that. Harvey went in, and as forecasted, it meandered and meandered and meandered. And as the hurricanes move over land, their energy is released in the form of rain. Several days out before the storm even had strengthened into a hurricane again, there were predictions of 25, 35 inches of rain over Texas, and there were a lot of people thinking, are you crazy? You can't predict that thing for something that hasn't even formed yet. But then as the Harvey got strong and we realized 25 to 35 is probably an underestimate, and as it turned out, it was 50 to 60 inches. Now you're measuring rain in feet, 4 and 5 feet of water. That was pretty much unprecedented. In fact, the 50 to 60 inches that Texas received from Harvey was the most ever from a landfalling tropical storm on the U.S. mainland.
You know, there's been a lot of concern about aging satellites. How are we doing in terms of gathering atmospheric data?
We're doing real well. GOES-R, now GOES-16, was launched last year. It is, as we speak, being moved into its final position in space, and that'll take about another week and a half to do. And that has been a tremendous upgrade in what we can do with satellites. We've also got the Polar Orbiting Satellite, which went up into space a couple of weeks ago. That will be very useful as well. So the satellite technology is there. What we really need to do is just be able to better communicate the hazards of an approaching hurricane to the people that are in its path. They've got to understand what they're facing, and they've got to be able to react and protect themselves.
And there were also concerns about funding for the Hurricane Hunter planes, which you still use. Has that been resolved?
We still use the Hurricane Hunter planes. That's like an MRI for the hurricane. Those are still flying.
You know, the National Hurricane Center made some changes this season in terms of how the hurricane tracks and other things are depicted. Tell us what that changes.
Yeah, we did. We had a couple of new products here. Thanks for raising that issue. Of course, the maps look a whole lot better. They're more visually appealing. That always helps. So, you know, like a TV graphic, you know, you want it to grab its attention. But we introduced a couple of new products this year, one of which was the experimental first arrival of tropical storm force winds. So you look at the map and it says, okay, the storm is down here. This line, which says, for sake of argument, 48 hours. Okay, it's at that time when tropical storm force winds are expected to reach you. And at that point, it's a little too late to be putting up shutters. And most emergency management will pull their people off the streets when the tropical storm force winds are blowing. So that was a really, really good thing to have. The other thing we did this year was issued 7 times this year what was called, we initiated advisories on what we called a potential tropical cyclone. And looking back at it, you think, well, why would you issue something for something that hasn't formed? Well, the way the system had been set up for years was you couldn't start advisories unless you had a true tropical system. In other words, it had to be at least a tropical depression. Well, sometimes that doesn't happen until that's on your doorstep, and that's a little late to put warnings up. But the forecasting has become so much better and the technology so much better that when we have a high confidence that this is going to turn into a tropical storm and impact somebody within 48 hours, we can go ahead and start writing advisories and throw the watches and warnings up. We did that 7 times this year, and only one of those storms failed to develop. So that is a true success story as well. You get that advanced warning and watches before the storm is even formed.
You know, I've lived in Florida just about most of my life. That's going up on 4 decades, and I've been through a lot of different storms. So I know when one is coming, I take everything very seriously. I think about the fact, though, that Florida, South Florida especially, hadn't been hit for so many years. And you have a lot of people who've never been through it, who never experienced it. If you could take one good thing out of this experience of having these storms, especially Irma for South Florida, that people who never experienced it now know, right? That, well,
that's true.
Take it seriously.
I'll take that one step farther for you, Lewis. Those of us in South Florida who had a hurricane plan, had all your provisions, had everything ready, and implemented that plan, unquestionably did far better than those who had no hurricane plan at all. So this was a real lesson learned for folks who didn't have a hurricane plan. And it's my hope that going into the 2018 season, now less than 6 months away, that they have their hurricane plan in place.
You know, it's Monday, and you just ruined it by making us reminding us that we're just 6 months away from another hurricane season. Thanks so much, Dennis. I appreciate it.
Well, you know, we speak the truth here, brother.
I know, that's true. Dennis Felchin, meteorologist and spokesperson for the National Hurricane Center. Dennis, always a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you, and Merry Christmas.
All right. Well, coming up next, Miami Art Week is upon us, but what about the music? Yeah, we're going to talk about that. Coming up next on Sundial, here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, it's Miami Art Week leading up to Art Basel, and there will be a lot of art to appreciate and enjoy, but what about the music? It's going to be a lot of music that you can hear during the festivities, and we're joined now by Lauren Reskin of Sweat Records to tell us more about it. Lauren, great to have you back.
Thanks, Luis.
All right, let's start off with the big one. The big one, probably. Maybe it's just for me, right?
No, me too.
Wu-Tang Clan. All the members going to be performing?
They said it's going to be all the you know, current members. Obviously, rest in peace, ODB.
Right. No. Exactly. Right. You know what? It's going to be an amazing show. But what's the connection to the art?
So it's put on by Three Points, who throw their festival annually in October, and the three points of their festival are music, art, and technology. So, you know, they've always brought art into their music festival, so it's really cool that they're bringing music into our week of art festivals.
All right, you know what? This may just be me, but, you know, they're in the news because federal prosecutors trying to get a hold of the Wu-Tang Clan album, of which Martin Shkreli owns the only copy in the world. Do you think they're going to perform anything from this mysterious album?
I don't know.
I just picture them good. Get up on stage and say this is from that album.
That would be great. I just think if the album was that great, they probably would have wanted to release it to everyone.
That's true, too. You mentioned Three Points Festival bringing Bjork.
Yes, that's the one I think I'm the most excited about because she hasn't actually officially been in South Florida since her old band, the Sugar Cubes, played the Cameo Theater back in the late 80s.
That long?
Yeah, she's never played here as a solo artist. So she's doing, from what I hear, will be an immersive DJ set that could include singing and stage props and, of course, her amazing costumes. And she has an entirely new aesthetic for this new album that just came out called Utopia. And it's beautiful. And I just really can't wait to see what she's bringing.
Is there a reason why she hasn't been back to South Florida in that long?
I mean, we all have our theories, but, you know, we're just really happy to have her. I know there's, you know, from personal experience selling records to people for almost 20 years, thousands of Bjork fans down here. And, you know, any live date she ever announces that's like a full-on show will sell out instantaneously.
And that's another category, too. The DJs, who else is going to be in town?
Well, let's see here. We have Diplo is going to be at LIV. There's a ton of places around that have DJs. I mean, that's par for the course down here in Miami. You know, clubs like Basement at Addition and Space and new spots like 1-800 Lucky and Las Rosas will have a variety of entertainment going on all week long. But, you know, for me, it's cool that with Art Basel, you kind of get a little more international artists than usual. Because, you know, those are pricier shows, and during Art Basel, there's a little more money to go around. So, you know, it's nice. We have on Wednesday, Cut Copy from Australia playing at the North Beach Bandshell. And then later that night, the soul funk group Jungle are playing at The Ground.
All right. Cut Copy. I was actually listening to a little bit of their music. I'm going to have to admit, I didn't know anything about these guys. They're from Australia.
Yeah, they're great.
And one of the descriptions was that they think Depeche Mode or... So, really?
Yeah, they're very like synth pop. You know, they're indie band, but with a lot of electronics.
Going back to my childhood of the 80s.
I think you'd like them. They're very good. They have a string of great albums out, and I've seen them live before, and they're fantastic.
You know, I mean, you think about Art Week, and you think about Art Basel, and it's you think about really the art. But, you know, why is there not more emphasis on some of the music, or is that meant to be put as a side thing?
Well, one of the things that I know we all used to love down here was the giant free concerts that Art Basel proper would put on the sand, on the beach. They used to erect a stage and hosted some incredible live shows, Iggy Pop and the Stooges, Fisher Spooner, Scissor Sisters. And those are all really beloved concerts that people still talk about. And that went away a few years ago. So it's really cool that so many independent promoters and outfits throughout Miami have sort of, you know, continued the tradition of having really cool live music, because there are a lot of people in town and locals still want to be able to do stuff. So it's nice that it's not a void for music. In fact, it's the opposite.
Again, talking with Lauren Reskin of Sweat Records. And what we're talking about is the music during Miami Art Week and Art Basel, which is coming up. And, you know, again, lots of art to see. But what about some of the entertainment outside of that as well? You know what? Besides Art Basel, there's also Soul Basel this week. Old school to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Black Archives. Mm-hmm. But just a little bit about Soul Basel.
Yeah, that's at the Lyric Theater, and it's over a few days. They have some really cool sort of, you know, classic legacy artists from disco and hip-hop. They have the SOS Band, and they have Dougie Fresh and the Sugar Hill Gang. So those are, I think, on the Wednesday and Thursday night, and you can find those tickets online.
All right. Moving up in time, let's see, from the 70s to the 90s, a band some people love to hate, Royal Trucks. am I saying that right, by the way?
Yeah, Royal Trucks.
Thank you. All right. Yep. Tell us about them.
They are going to be on Friday night at Churchill's for a kind of homegrown series called the Look Alive Fest. And they're playing with Wolf Eyes and Drew McDowell from Coil. So it's pretty much a different... I mean, it's great. It really fills a hole in the Art Basel Music Week that, you know, is rock, is experimental, is weird, passionately weird.
What are your plans? I mean, you know, for when you think about the Art Week, what are your plans? Are you just going and looking for the music, or is it just part of your experience, your overall experience of Art Week?
Well, I sort of use the shows that I really want to see as, like, you know, marking points. Like, okay, well, I'm definitely hitting Bjork on Tuesday, and I'm definitely hitting Jungle on Wednesday. And then around that, I sort of fill in my week with, you know, what I have to do for work and the art shows that I want to see during the day and my DJ gigs and the other things I kind of have going on. So I definitely, you know, make sure that the shows go in my calendar first, because I'm not going to miss them.
What do they get right? What do they get wrong?
What?
Just Art Week, the Art Week in general, but the music in general. What do they get right? What do they get wrong?
I mean, this year I think the programming's cool. There's, you know, a handful of shows that are interesting to a variety of people. And for people who don't even care at all, there's even further alternative programming. There's a few nights at Churchill's that are specifically, one's called Anti-Art Becomes Art, and it's a bunch of really wild experimental stuff. And there's another one called Art Basel Distraction. So I think it's cool. I mean, I think the city sort of provides for itself what it needs. And, you know, the international people come in and you know, do their thing. But most of these good shows are actually homegrown. I think that's awesome.
Again, talking with Lauren Reskin of Sweat Records, because we are talking about Miami Art Week, but not just the art. We're talking about the music. I want to come back, and we talked about Cut Copy. Tell us a little bit about Jungle. It's a group from Britain,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they're a soul collective from the UK. They put out an incredible self-titled album at the end of 2014 called Jungle, and it's on XL Records, which is home to a ton of other great artists like the XX and so many others. And it was just a really sort of, you know, unique album with a wide appeal. It's got a little bit of Massive Attack. It's got a little bit of hip-hop flavor. And, you know, there's a wide variety of tastes for the people that work at Sweat Records. And it was one of those albums that everybody was into. So it's been a great crowd pleaser. And, you know, they're a large group. And I really didn't expect to see them in Miami anytime soon. So this, to me, is one of the greatest gets of the festival, is that we get this, like, pretty big band from Europe playing.
Now let's come back. Where's Jungle performing? Where's Cut Copy performing?
Sure. Cut Copy's at the North Beach Bandshell. It's an early show because it's outdoors. So that's doors at 6:00. And Jungle is playing at The Ground, which is the ground floor of Club Space on 11th Street. Doors for that one are at 8.
All right. What about classical music performances for the week?
I'm sure that New World Symphony is doing some stuff, and I definitely know that I believe New Deco are playing the Sagamore Brunch on the Sunday.
Okay.
I'm sure there's more beyond that. I was really sort of focusing on the out-of-town stuff that's coming in, and I haven't heard of any random classical coming in from out of town.
How about really artsy installations with sound, which look good?
Well, Spinello Gallery has another installation by Nama Tsebar, who's a really great artist who does multimedia stuff, and she focuses on sound a lot. She did a really cool installation last year in the front garden of the Bass Museum, and she has another one this year, the art fair called Untitled. They have a thing they do every year called Untitled Radio, and they're featuring some really cool sounds and sound art. The local group Archival Feedback are doing a special presentation for that, and they've done everything from, like, record the actual sounds of Hurricane Irma and turn that into art. So, you know, they always do something interesting, and I believe you can tune into that on the Wynwood Radio app or on just the TuneIn Radio app.
All right. I know that there are always parties I will never be invited to. I will never get into. And they probably have really good performances going on that, again, I'm going to have to miss. But do you know of any?
I mean, yeah, there's a lot. And, you know, those sort of parties are the kind where, you know, you just try to RSVP in advance or make the line or sneak in some other way. I know Jesse Boykins III is playing somewhere. I honestly haven't looked at too many of those because I haven't seen too many of the artists that, you know, piqued my particular fancy, but, you know, there's great guides online. Jose Duran from the New Times always does a killer Art Basel party guide. Paper Magazine usually does one, so, you know, worth checking out for the deeper dives on those.
One of my favorite things, too, is what's free or not so expensive.
Well, anything at Churchill's is going to be on the cheaper side, which is cool. There's a bunch of local shows at Wynwood Yard. There's some things that you can see just by going to an art fair. The band Superchunk are doing an acoustic set at NADA on Thursday. So that's, you know, with admission to the fair, you get a show. Red Bull Sound Select is doing a showcase Tuesday night with a few local and non-local artists. So that'll be on the lower side of things.
And is there anything also outside of Art Week? Just, you know, some regular performances that you might also recommend?
Well, I mean, you know, some of these aren't necessarily related to Art Week, but, you know, they're there for everyone. So I think that's cool.
So I think, as you said, that what you're looking forward to most is Bjork. Give me your top three. What are the shows? If you could do any of the shows, you're telling anybody what to do. Which ones are you? Which three outside of, I guess, Bjork?
I mean, you know, Jungle's a don't miss. I love Wu-Tang, so I would probably enjoy seeing them again. And, hey, there's the Phil Collins Gala at the Fillmore on Saturday, and Phil's just a classy dude, and he's got his Dreams Foundation, and they raise money for...
And say again, where's he going to be?
He's at the Fillmore, and there's some other big artists performing with him, and he sort of, like, leads the night.
It's Phil Collins.
It's Phil Collins,
you can't
you
miss with that.
Yeah.
Lauren Reskin, again, from Sweat Records, talking about the music for the upcoming Art Week, for Art Week and Art Basel. Check it out. We'll have more information on our website. Lauren, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Lewis.
And I think let's go out with a little bit of Jungle. This is from their song. I think it's called Time, if I'm not mistaken. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, if you notice that there are a lot of iguanas hanging around, well, it turns out that with the warm winters that we've had recently, that's kind of led to this big boom of iguanas everywhere. Now, some people are bothered by them and others are not, but the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission has got a plan on how to help you deal with them. They're going to be holding workshops starting this month in different parts of the state to, again, give you some ideas on how to deal with the iguanas. I spoke with Eric Suarez of the FWC to learn a little bit more about what exactly they're going to be talking about.
So within a community, they can cause some damage to our natural resources as far as basically eating these some of these non-native plants that people might put in their landscape, or just other non-native plants that have been established in Florida, and can disperse these seeds as iguanas are functional seed dispersers, then thus spreading these non-native plants to areas where they may not have occurred originally. Also, in the Keys, green iguanas have been documented consuming the knickerbean plant, which is an important plant to the Miami blue butterfly because it's the larval host plant that these Miami blue butterflies need to survive. And although the impacts on the knickerbean plant and the Miami blue butterfly, as far as iguanas goes, hasn't been documented that well to say that green iguanas are attributing to the decline of the Miami blue butterfly populations, they still have some type of impact for those species. Also, green iguanas have been documented living in burrows of the state-listed burrowing owl and gopher tortoises, which definitely causes competition there and may displace some of these species.
What do we know about how they got here? I mean, is this just a case of, like, with the python, people just wanted them as pets and then let them go?
So, you know, we can't say 100% sure that iguanas got here through the pet trade, but it is the large consensus, you know, amongst biologists and agencies that they probably did come through the pet trade. Although there are other means of non-native species getting to Florida, whether it be through cargo or the plant trade and other means as well.
Are there any rules against people just killing them?
No, there aren't, although that if you are going to remove them from your property, or in this case, kill them, as you mentioned, it has to be a humane euthanasia. We do not want these iguanas to suffer. We definitely, iguanas are protected by anti-cruelty laws, and inhumane treatment of these iguanas is punishable by law. So things like poisons are not legal to be used to be able to remove these iguanas from your property. But there's other ways to be able to remove these iguanas from your property, like trapping them. But anything that is done as far as killing these iguanas definitely has to be in a humane way.
We've seen a growth in the iguana population because the last couple of winters have actually been pretty warm. And the cold weather actually sort of controls their population, correct?
Yes, and that may be one of the reasons why not much has been done as far as management goes of green iguanas in Florida. Back in 2010, we had a pretty good freeze down here and really, really reduced the populations of iguanas in South Florida. But since then, like you mentioned, we haven't had many cold winters, and that could definitely be attributing to that population increase throughout the state.
Is there any program that you've seen anywhere in the world that was successful in dealing with an invasive species, or are we just going to have to live with iguanas here in South Florida?
That's a great question. I don't have the answer for, you know, if there's been any successful removals of invasives elsewhere in the world. You know, we've been working hard here in Florida to manage other species of invasives that have occurred here, and we've been pretty successful at removing a few through our early detection and rapid response efforts. Now, can we say for sure that these populations have been eliminated and they're not there anymore? You know, we're still doing a lot of monitoring efforts to make sure that some of these animals have been removed, but it's a huge task. It's really hard to be able to remove and eradicate a species like the green iguana, where they're so widespread. We don't want to say that we've lost the battle with potentially eradicating green iguanas. With these workshops and us working with partnering agencies and other and the homeowners, we're really trying to see if we have a chance in this battle versus green iguanas. And by getting everybody involved, and basically, you know, we like to use the model here in the agency that it takes a village to try and remove all these non-native species from our environment. And it really does. And this is what we're trying to do with these workshops and try and get a chance to be able to at least manage the population as much as possible to be able to just minimize those impacts that these iguanas are having on our ecology, on our economy, and our human quality of life.
Again, that's Eric Suarez. He's with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, and we were talking about iguanas and how to best deal with this growth of iguana population that we've seen throughout South Florida. Again, we're going to have information on our website coming up later today on when these workshops will be held and how you could participate. Well, that's our program for today. Thank you so much for listening. That's Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez.